On this edition for Saturday, November 30th, the latest on the London Bridge terrorist attack. And in our signature segment, reviving an endangered language one student at a time. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Allison Stewart.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us. Investigators in the United Kingdom are searching for clues about how a convicted terrorist was able to plan and carry out a stabbing attack yesterday. He killed two people and wounded three others near London Bridge. London's counterterrorism officials named the suspect as 28-year-old Usman Khan. Khan pled guilty to terrorism charges in 2012 for a plot to blow up the London Stock Exchange.
I've been born and bred in England, in Stoke-on-Trent and Coatbridge.
Last year, he was released early from his 16-year sentence and ordered to wear an ankle monitor and participate in a rehabilitation program. Police said the attack began at an event for prisoner rehabilitation, which the suspect was attending near London Bridge. Before police arrived, bystanders tackled the suspect. Video on Twitter showed people chasing the attacker using a fire extinguisher and an ornamental 5-foot narwhal tusk pulled from the building where the attack began. Police shot and killed the suspect when they saw he was wearing what appeared to be a suicide vest. It was a fake. London's mayor Sadiq Khan praised the bystanders.
These people ignore all the advice that they're given, which is to run away from danger, to look after your own safety, and instead ran towards danger to make sure others were safe. And I'm just so incredibly proud as the mayor, and I think all of us should be proud of what our fellow citizens did yesterday, including the police.
Today, police said one of the victims was 25-year-old Jack Merritt, who was involved with coordinating the rehabilitation event. Prime Minister Boris Johnson called for a review of the country's automatic early release policy.
It does not make sense for us as a society to be putting people convicted of terrorist offences, of serious violent offences, out on early release. And we argue that people should serve the term of which they're sentenced.
Just a few hours after the London attack, three teenagers in the Netherlands were injured in a separate stabbing incident on a busy shopping street in The Hague. All the victims have now been treated and released from the hospital. In a statement, police said they are still searching for a male suspect and said the suspect's motive is, quote, unclear. Hundreds of older activists, many retirees, joined young anti-government protesters in Hong Kong today for a peaceful unity rally. Participants sang Glory to Hong Kong, an unofficial anthem of the demonstrations, and held signs urging citizens to continue to fight for freedom and democracy. Organizers said that the older generation wanted the government to know that the young protesters will not be abandoned. Hong Kong has been relatively calm since local elections last week resulted in victories for many pro-democracy candidates. Iraq's cabinet approved the resignation of Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi today, one day after he promised to step down. Parliament must now accept Mahdi's resignation for it to be valid and could decide the matter tomorrow. Despite the prime minister's vow to step down, demonstrations continued today. Four protesters were killed and at least 26 others were wounded. The ongoing anti-government protests began in early October and more than 400 people have died. And in Malta, Prime Minister Joseph Muscat is expected to resign over a scandal involving the 2017 assassination of a journalist and corruption allegations. Daphne Caruana Galizia had been investigating corruption before her death in a car bombing. Three men have been arrested for carrying out the bombing, but no trial date has been set. Close aides to Muscat have allegedly been linked to the killing. Even if he resigns, Muscat may remain as prime minister until January when Malta's Labour Party holds its leadership election. On the busiest travel weekend of the year, the weather is not making things merry and bright. A storm system moving across the Midwest and into the Northeast will bring snow, rain, and high winds. Airlines have already canceled hundreds of flights, and there were thousands of flight delays today. The Midwest saw heavy snow, and up to 4 inches of snow mixed with rain is expected in New York City starting tomorrow. Another weather system will bring heavy rain and snow to the West Coast this weekend. While the holiday shopping and celebrating season gets underway in the U.S. this weekend, in Austria, it was time for something completely different. The annual Krampus Run in a town in southern Austria brought people dressed as the mythical half-goat, half-demon creature into the streets. In case you are mystified, Krampus is kind of Santa Claus's evil twin. In Europe, he is believed to tag along with Santa, a.k.a. Saint Nick, to punish naughty children. Gives new meaning to the phrase, he's going to find out who's naughty or nice. For more news from around the world, including the latest on Friday's terror attacks in London, visit pbs.org/newshour. November is National Native American Heritage Month. As it comes to a close, we have an intimate look at New York's Mohawk tribe and its fight to restore and maintain its language and culture for the next generation and beyond. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Jenna Flanagan has our story.
The language gives us our identity. It teaches us the culture. It teaches us how to be. It teaches us how to be grateful. And without that, who are we?
That's Elvira Sargent, an elder member of the Akwesasne Mohawk Nation, which lies at the northern border of New York State. The Mohawk are working hard to not only maintain their language, but ensure it has a future with its language immersion school. The Akwesasne Freedom School was founded in 1979 after decades of Mohawk children being forcibly removed from their families and native lands to attend boarding schools run by priests, where English was mandatory and the Mohawk language forbidden, effectively putting up a barrier between the people and their culture. Freedom School Level 4 teacher Dohone Alakde, or as he's known by his English name, Levi Hearn, explains the long-term cultural effect.
Most of the families in this community aren't traditional, because of what had happened with boarding schools and different types of assimilation with like the Jesuits, even in the 16, 1700s.
Elvira says she remembers her family members struggling with the separation.
My sister actually went to a residential school with my uncle, and they would be there all year, come home if once a year. But what I know with that is that they were not allowed to speak the language. They were punished. My sister doesn't know the culture at all. She still knows the language. She gets stuck. So it has had a lasting impact. There's maybe people my age and maybe a little older. We didn't have that nurturing from our parents, because they didn't know how to nurture us or show us love. We knew they loved us, but oh, God. But it was hard for them to show us.
The boarding school separations left a lasting impact on the family. However, Elvira was too young to be taken to boarding school, so she learned to speak Mohawk at home.
That's all I heard growing up. But then eventually even that part got lost.
And is that same natural way that guides the Freedom School.
We actually start at the age of one, where they can go into our language nest. Because long time ago, this was their first language. Not all parents can speak the language, so they're not hearing it until they enter school.
And the focus is on developing conversational skills over compulsory.
I think they really should try to learn it with another speaker, with an elder. I'm afraid with it being in a classroom all the time, that it's going to become a classroom language. And I don't want to see that happen.
It's just before 8 a.m. at the Akwesasne Freedom School, and the kids are already getting dropped off for the day. The school encompasses a small campus of three buildings, but it's not structured like an American public school. The kids aren't regulated by grade, but rather their Mohawk language ability level. So a child at level two isn't necessarily a second grader, but rather a kid whose conversational skills are still developing. And that child can be any age.
My name is Gasanogohe. Can you say it?
Gasanogohe?
Yep, Gasanogohe.
Clearly, I am a newcomer to the language. But Gasanogohe is not only proficient, she's the level 8 language teacher and breaks down Mohawk pronunciation in a way my English-only brain can process it.
Her. And this is comes from the word Gasana, which means a name, and this gohe is a journey. She Who Retrieves Names.
That is so amazing that that's your name given what you teach. For
And that's one of the tenets of the Mohawk Way, or culture. Every individual has their own name, just one that's unique to themselves.
This is Gay.
As she continues explaining the phonetics to me, she shares how modern-day speakers make the ancient language work in present day.
So our language is descriptive. So the way we've adapted to all these new words is just to describe what is going on.
How would you then describe what a journalist does? Like, if I were to describe myself in the Mohawk language, how would I call myself?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. Maybe Yegaladus.
She tells
stories.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Wait, how do I spell that?
Yegaladus. I could spell it for you on the board.
Oh, please do.
This ye is pronoun for her, and this dun is the telling of, and this is habitual. So she is a teller. She is a storyteller.
I absolutely love that.
Working with Longhouse traditions, the Akwesasne Freedom School has its own set of standards and requirements for teachers. They aren't looking for traditional American certificates or degrees, but rather a membership within the nation, fluency in the Mohawk culture and language, and above all, a passion for imparting those traditions onto the next generation. Throughout the school, the kids are encouraged to help one another in their language development, and in some classrooms, absolutely no English is spoken at all. So to further my meager Mohawk language skills, I turned to some of the school's most enthusiastic teachers, the 7 and 8-year-olds in level 2.
Sego. Sego, what does that mean?
Hi.
Hi, Sego, is that how you say it?
Hi.
Ona.
Gana Lactas, or as she's known by her English name, Tara Skitters, is the school's office manager. She handles admissions, budgeting, hiring, and ensuring the school meets its overall mission. And part of that is creating a familial atmosphere for the kids.
So it's a very small percentage of people that come here. The families that want their kids here, a lot of them are traditional, who, you know, follow the Longhouse and the Longhouse traditions. I think our overall, like, values are more the concentration, respect, and taking care of the earth, and being kind to one another.
Even though the Freedom School has less than 100 kids enrolled, the Akwesasne Mohawk community is 16,000 strong, and the reservation overlaps the U.S.-Canadian border. So kids who live on the New York side also have friends and family in the Ontario and Quebec provinces. The Freedom School has students from both sides of the border, but according to Level 4 teacher Dohoni Alakte, that's our border, not theirs.
When they're here, they talk about being on the American or Canadian side, because we ourselves don't feel as we're a part of the American or Canadian government. We feel that we're a sovereign nation still.
Tara says one of the biggest worries that parents have is if all this Mohawk immersion will limit their child's ability to learn English and matriculate into one of the nearby public high schools.
The reality is English is everywhere. They're going to learn it, but once they leave here, where are they going to learn the Mohawk language?
In all, Tara says the mission of the Akwesasne Freedom School is to ensure the survival of the Mohawk culture and language.
You know, people think that an Indian is a certain way, or that we all are the same, and we're not. There's so many different nations, different clothes, different cultures, different songs. Everything is different, and you know, we have to work really hard to maintain those things. There's so little of us, you know, like compared to other populations, but we're here, we're doing it, we're gonna keep doing it, we're not going nowhere. We have kids who are learning all this stuff, and they're going to carry it on, and that's, we're just doing our thing.
In public schools across the state of Illinois, the use of, quote, isolated timeout was allowed if students allegedly posed a threat to themselves or others. They were detained in quiet rooms. But a year-long investigation by ProPublica Illinois and the Chicago Tribune found that this practice was regularly used for minor school incidents, sometimes on children as young as 5 years old. For context, incidents included not doing homework or spilling milk. Jody Cohen is a reporter for ProPublica Illinois and is one of the reporters behind the Quiet Rooms investigation. She recently spoke with Hari Srinivasan about her findings.
So, Jody, what is the practice of seclusion and what happens in Illinois?
So in Illinois and in other places around the country, there are schools where students are taken to isolated spaces, seclusion rooms. Sometimes they're called quiet rooms or reflection rooms or reset rooms. Staff put them there and they shut the door.
Okay, now, you know, some parents are going to say, well, what's so wrong about a timeout when somebody is misbehaving and they're going to disrupt the whole class? Isn't it good to get somebody out of that environment?
So just to be clear, this is not a timeout where a parent would go and say, you need a timeout. Isolated timeout, as it's called in Illinois, is in the law. It's a technique that can be used if a student is a danger to themselves, another student, a staff member. But what we found in Illinois was that isolated timeout was being used for reasons that did not have to do with safety, that students were being put in seclusion when they were disruptive, when they were not following rules, when they were not complying.
Was this happening in some places more than others?
What we found was it was happening all around the state. We ultimately documented more than 20,000 incidents of seclusion in a school year, plus a little bit more of the next school year, all over Illinois, traditional school districts and special education cooperatives.
Okay, in some of those special education cooperatives, you have several different stories of what some of these children do to themselves in these rooms. You talk about an autistic boy named Jace. Tell me what happened there.
So we saw Jace was repeatedly put in the quiet rooms at his school. Sometimes it was because he didn't want to do his math work or he would leave the classroom and he would cry, he would urinate, he would defecate. They would leave him in the room. We show one incident where he was, you know, crying in that room. He was saying, I'm crying alone. And he was in there for hours.
And this was all documented how?
So in Illinois, when children were put in isolated timeout, staff members had to document what was happening during that seclusion, what led to the seclusion, how long the student was put in seclusion, and what happened inside. So you would see in Jace's incident, for example, it would say 10:53, and it would quote him, I'm crying alone, 10:55. It would go minute by minute, and we have those records from schools all across Illinois.
Did the parents of these students that entrusted their students to these institutions know that this was happening?
So the schools are required to tell parents within 24 hours to give them some sort of written notice. But what we found was that the notifications often would be put in the mail, and in rural parts of Illinois, sometimes they would get there a week later, and they wouldn't have that full incident report that I was just describing. Instead, they would get a form that had a check mark, like your child was put in isolated timeout on this day, and that would be it.
When you showed Jace's mom a record of what he went through, what happened?
So Jace died last year. He died of a seizure in his sleep. He had epilepsy as well as autism. We showed her the reports, and she just cried and cried. She said, I had no idea they wrote all of this down, and she just said, why? Why didn't I know any of this?
So the concern here is that a lot of these places are using this kind of as a default response instead of a last resort.
Yes. So for some schools, this became like the only tool in their toolbox. Instead of a last resort, this was the result.
And you actually have diagrams of what these spaces look like. You were able to see some of this. Is there anything consistent about them? I mean, it seems like some of the rooms are padded and some of them are not. And kids are, what, banging their head against the wall in some cases?
Some of them had blue padding. Others were really cement blocks, cinder blocks, tiles. They're very stark spaces. But most of them are very, very small, barren spaces.
Okay, so what's happened since your reporting?
So we published the story on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Governor Pritzker, the Illinois governor, called the practice appalling and ordered an immediate end to it. So the Illinois State Board of Education wrote emergency rules that went into effect immediately on Wednesday that banned all types of isolated seclusion, meaning that a child can never be in a room by him or herself. A trained adult has to be in the space, and it can never be locked. Mm-hmm. What else happened this week as part of the emergency rules is now within 48 hours of a timeout, that has to be reported to the state. And the state has also ordered all school districts to send information from this current school year and the two prior school years to the state so that the state can have data and see where this practice was being used the most mm-hmm. and then take a look. The governor's office also filed complaints for every child named in the investigation that we did, and they are taking complaints from families now, and they say they're going to investigate all of them.
This is great work in Illinois. What about the rest of the country? How do the other states deal with this idea of secluding kids?
So there are 19 states that ban some or all form of seclusion. Other states allow it, like the same way Illinois does. There has been federal legislation introduced for many of the past sessions that would ban seclusion across the country. It's called the Keeping All Students Safe Act. And there are plans to reintroduce it in the current Congress. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. Jody Cohen of ProPublica joining us from Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, our colleague Megan Thompson welcomed a new addition to the NewsHour weekend family this week, just in time for Thanksgiving. Theo Thompson Perez was born Wednesday morning, weighing in at 6 pounds, 15 ounces. Congratulations to Megan, Jonathan, and big brother Elliot. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour weekend. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for watching. Have a good night.